this story, please, and let your friends know. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Perptine, Augusta Messiah-Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Trina Nadara, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM, K296 FT West Haven, serving Portland at 107.1 FM, and K219 KU Nehalem, serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 FM. Streaming live and archived at xray.fm. Radio is yours. Thanks for being here. This is Margaret Malone, and you're listening to another episode of Bust the Canon, a literary interview series where we talk to writers about writers they love and listen in as they tune us in to authors from the past, present, and future, often lesser known than we'd like them to be, writers who have often been working outside the literary canon U.S. readers are familiar with. Today, we'll be talking with Lydia Yuknovich. Lydia is the author of the memoirs Reading the Waves and The Chronology of Water, as well as the novels Thrust, The Book of Joan, The Small Backs of Children, and Dora, A Headcase. Lydia has received 2 Oregon Book Awards and a PNBA Award. She's the founder of the micro arts organization Corporeal Writing in Portland, Oregon, where she teaches collaboratively with Janice Lee, Dami Shoemaker, Daniel Elder, Katie Gwynn, and June Mayorama, also known as The Squad. Lydia received her PhD in literature from the University of Oregon, and the film version of The Chronology of Water was adapted and directed by Kristen Stewart this year and is currently streaming. Lydia is also a very good swimmer. Lydia, hello.
Hello.
We're live in the studio.
I know, I love you.
I'm so happy to see you.
I'm happy to see you too.
Really happy you're here. Thank you so much for being here. I'm reading my line, which says, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, but it really is a pleasure to have you on the show.
The pleasure is mine, I promise you.
Okay, what's going on in your creative life? What are you up to, and what are you just thinking about creatively? What's happening?
Well, I've been sort of returning to something that I believe is repressed in me most of my life, which is painting. And I say it's been repressed in me because when I was a kid, I wanted to be a painter.
I didn't know that.
And my home situation with my dad sort of made me hide that it wasn't safe and it was creepy around him, and he would correct things or try to make him better himself. Or so I did that thing kids do, which is I hid it way far down in myself. And a few other times in my life, I sort of touched it for a second, but it just didn't play out. And this writing thing started coming for different reasons. So that's why I use the word something repressed in me, something down deep. And there's a sad part of this story and an awesome part of this story, like most things I tell. The sad part is I've been painting for the last year and a half because something in my life imploded, which was my marriage, my relationship, and my family and my living situation. And when I started painting, it was kind of to keep myself sane and alive. And I know enough to know if you can make a daily practice of something when you're in difficult times, you can help save your own life. So I was in therapy, high octane therapy. I had to move. I was living alone. I'm still living alone. But these paintings, you know, kept me going. The awesome part of the story is, I mean, this shouldn't have surprised me, but they are starting to tell me something. Mm. You know, they're not, what started off as a save your own life practice, like meditation or swimming, started talking back to me. And so a year and a half later, the paintings are sort of becoming more like stories and less like just practice this, do this, make a circle, make a circle. You know, they started off as that, but they're now evolving, I think, and kind of talking back to me.
Since you have this long ago seed of painting, when you picked it back up again, did it feel like picking up where you left off all those years ago? Did it feel like picking up where you left off with writing? Like, what was the handoff there for you?
Well, like I say, at first it was kind of desperate. It was just, can I do something during the day so I don't ace myself? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not afraid to talk like that, you know. I'm not afraid to say it was that bad. Yeah. So at first it was just sort of this, how do I stay on the planet move?
Yeah.
But somewhere along the line, a few things related to your question. I felt like I was saying things to myself like, it's okay to come out. Mm. I felt like I was going back and getting something. Mm-hmm. Not exactly retrieving your inner child, but not completely divorced from that either. Mm-hmm. Like reclaiming or recollecting or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the weird part was my hands were way ahead of me. My body was way ahead of me. And when I was painting, the fact that I'm ambidextrous came back.
Mm, that's cool.
But I haven't manifested that in my life until now. Mm-hmm. But something about the paintbrush, in relation to your question, made both my hands come alive.
That's cool.
And when people, like, I talk with my hands a lot. Mm-hmm. People tell me that all the time. And you see pictures of me, and it's, I'm there in the picture because I'm going like this. So I do it when I'm talking and apparently when I'm painting. Mm-hmm. So that has interested me.
Do you, was painting what your brain and body told you to do because writing was not an option, or was writing just like it didn't even occur to you, you had to do something else?
Writing receded in me. It got very far away. Part of my home situation and this breakup actually had some mixed up wires with my own writing. Mm-hmm. And so it's like a door shut or something. Mm-hmm. It wasn't writer's block or anything. It just receded. Maybe it was my adult version of keeping it safe during choppy seas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Actually, now that I'm saying that, I think it is that. Mm-hmm. But also, I tried. I would try to bring it back, and I've never not been able to write. So it was kind of foreign, like, what's going on here? But then I just trusted it, like, okay, it's resting. And it's only very recently that these paintings have started to, you know how we talk about portals at corporeal writing? Mm-hmm. The paintings are making story portals.
That's so cool.
And so it's coming back to me instead of me forcing it.
When you would be in your writing narrative brain, were you a visual writer? You would like walk into an image in your head or something and write
100%.
That? Yeah.
My whole writing life, I see it and hear it before I come to it with, you know, thinker brain or analytical or whatever we're calling it. It's always intuitive. It's always abstract. It's always image or sound or voice, something sensory. So, I mean, I think of my writing as highly visual and highly episodic, like panels or paintings, or more like how film is built. Mm-hmm. I don't know if other people see it that way, but that's how it plays out for me.
I've been rewriting a novel for a really long time, and just recently this year I've started to realize I'm writing installations. Like, each section is an installation you can walk into, like a room in an art
museum.
And I'm like, so it's reminding me of
I'm your ideal reader. Hurry up.
But it sounds like that, where it's like you walk around.
You are speaking my love language.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's funny you say that, because now I have, you didn't ask me, well, where are you keeping all those
Lydia,
paintings?
Lydia, where are you keeping all these paintings?
Under my bed.
Ooh.
So there's this slightly frightening big pile of like tablets and tablets of paintings. They're all about 18 by 24.
Once they go under your bed, do you look at them again?
Rarely.
Mm-hmm.
But it's occurred to me that as these paintings are emerging and story forms coming back to me, maybe, you know, an installation-y or way the somebody else could join me is more appropriate than, say, novel with flaps. But I don't know yet, because I'm still emergent. I'm a caterpillar.
I'm going to bungle this, but it could be Jungian psychology. I'm not sure, but what you were saying about not quite retrieval, but somewhere in the reading I've done, I remember hearing about how when you get to middle age, there's this analogy, I think, in Jungian psychology, that there's like a piece of luggage, like a suitcase you left somewhere as a kid. And when you go to middle age, you go and you pick the luggage back
up
and bring it with you.
It's 100% Jungian. And you're remembering perfectly, and it's correct. And also, I have this picture of myself when I was 4, when I was trying to run away from home, quote-unquote. And I had a little silver suitcase.
Oh, my gosh.
So I actually have that picture on my desk right now, reminding myself of this analogy you just described.
Oh, my gosh, that's crazy.
Because it's a version of that. Instead of running away, I'm doing something else.
So cool. That's fascinating. Okay. You're listening to Bust the Canon on X-Ray FM. We're talking to author Lydia Yuknovich, author of memoirs including Reading the Waves and The Chronology of Water, as well as the novels Thrust, The Book of Joan, The Small Backs of Children, and Dora, A Head Case, and apparently an art installation in process.
Something, maybe we could do it together.
I'm down.
We could have it.
I'm so down. Okay, let's get to the first question of the show.
Okay,
are you ready?
Okay.
Who's someone you feel like is... overlooked, you know, however you want to phrase that or interpret that, an overlooked author from the past you want to share with us today? And I'm always interested in knowing, you know, why you think their work is important. And I'm always interested in why they're overlooked as well. What do you got?
Yeah, so you had to know I was just going to take your questions and kind of play with them.
Please.
Yeah, so my answer isn't very surprising. And it's not exactly that she was overlooked. It's where she was situated in relationship to this thing called a canon, which I always picture as an actual canon, you know, and in a bad way.
Yeah, no, I get it. Is there a good canon? We'll come back to that at the end of the show.
Yeah. And so... the person, the writer, the artist is Kathy Acker. But it's not so much that she never got attention. She certainly got attention, and especially in the punk scene and cyberpunk scene and in outsider scene. It's not so much that. It's that I was thinking about this. I'm very attracted to the edges of what we've inherited as the canon. And those writers and artists who agitate those edges. They're important to me. And she certainly, one could say, is an artist or a writer who agitated the edges of the dominant shape. Or I think of it as like a sphere. And I would go farther and say she made an actual gash in the order of things. And if anyone's ever read her, her writing is pretty brutal for the reader in many ways. And so it's not that I'm championing that so much as two things happen. When I first encountered her writing, it was the first time in my life I felt seen. which is very weird if you ever read her work, anybody. But here's how I felt seen. I'll give you the cipher. What had happened to me as a child in my household with major sexual and emotional abuse was playing out in her plot lines and her pages and her fictions as if it was worth epic stories in a novel. Mm-hmm. And as if it had something to teach us about activism and resistance and revolution. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't seen any other woman writer do that so graphically and viscerally and, you know, explicitly. That's why I use the word gash. And so that's why I'm naming her. It's not that I think everybody should go read Kathy Acker. It's that I think, can we keep in the conversation what's happening at the edges that's important for resistance, agitation, revolution, turning something over? And she, for me, was that. And then the second thing I would say is, I don't know if this is true for you or other people, but in my life, it's never been a single author. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a famous author that mm-hmm. has super impacted me. It's these little star clusters that burst. Mm-hmm. And with Kathy Acker, it was this book that was a collection called Angry Women. Mm. And collected inside this book was Kathy Acker and Bell Hooks and Diamanda Galas and Annie Sprinkle and Susie Bright. And, you know, these women who were pissed off, Karen Finley, a lot of them were performance artists, mm-hmm. but also writing, mm-hmm. Sapphire, mm-hmm. all in this one book. And I hit that book and my life changed because of this chorus of voices mm-hmm. and bodies, not like a single writer. And she was in there in a very personal way for me. So those are kind of the two reasons, mm-hmm. her. And also, she's still not included in the canon. She's been ejected for life. She's no longer alive. But, you know, you'd think at a certain point there would be this category of, like, gash writers.
And some of people excluded from the canon have been welcomed in.
Yeah,
like,
they
I
have.
Think about Toni Morrison that
yeah,
way. She
yeah.
was way outside, and now she is canon.
Yeah, yeah.
But not everybody.
No, apparently.
And why do you think not?
Oh, I think it's obvious in Kathy Acker's case, the brutality and explicit violence of, you know, her willingness to say very difficult things about capitalism and colonialism and rape and violence actually on the bodies of women and children, mm-hmm. Her explicit details about that, she's never going to get it. Mm-hmm. But she will find some readers like me who then inherit her vibe. Mm-hmm. And of myself, I think I'm a writer who attempts agitation. I make an infiltration move first. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I try to agitate the edges. And I think I add an ingredient, which is aftercare.
Mm. Okay, talk about that for a minute.
Well, when I think about it, I think, like, Chronology of Water was me opening the gash, but also including aftercare with some humor, with some beauty, with some questions that open to the reader. And I even think the arts organization we made, Corporeal Writing, includes the idea that we're going to look at difficult things, we're going to draw work out of each other that may leave you trembling, but there's aftercare. Mm. And I don't think Acker was doing aftercare.
How? Yeah, I mean, it's not. It's interesting how in art, all art, I think, you know, there are some people who want to see the thing all the way through, beginning, middle, end, and some people are just
yeah.
there for the whatever, the
that's
breaking
right.
of the glass or whatever it is, and then
that's
it's
right.
someone else's job.
And I don't judge wherever anyone as right. an artist is on that spectrum at all. I'm just, these are things I've learned about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've gravitated toward and why, mm-hmm. and what I learned from it and what I walked away from. And, you know, mm-hmm. these are things I'm still learning.
How old were you when you found Kathy Acker and or that book?
I think it came out in 91, mm-hmm. and I'm 62 now, so whatever that math is. Mm-hmm.
Late 20s?
Yeah, that sounds right, because yeah. I started writing, quote-unquote, pretty, like, oh, look, words are coming out on a page, when I was around 25 or 26. So I bet that book was a starburst that opened a portal for me.
So you had started writing a little by the time you found your way to her?
A teeny bit.
Yeah.
Not very much.
Uh-huh. Mm. What got you started writing?
Trauma.
Uh-huh.
When my daughter died.
Right.
I had a part of my psyche that broke down, and I generally entered psychosis, and I was living under an underpass in Eugene. I say living. I had a place to live, but I kept going there mm-hmm. and sleeping with other outsider misfit people. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that began to be a bridge back to the world for me and back to college and back to being a person was I had some kind of loony looking fragments written in a notebook. And at a certain point, the fragments began to have patterns, and the patterns had stories about girls and women in them. And it was probably part of bringing me back to life.
Did anyone recommend to you to start writing in those days, or were you just on your own carrying a notebook around? And
I was on my own carrying a notebook around, but certainly therapists talked to me about, you know, talk therapy is a form of entering story, right? Absolutely. And then, of course, my sister, who was teaching in Eugene, the second she saw me making any, even like a not good story, she was there to reflect back to me that story space is real.
You're the second. So the person, I did an interview with someone for Amplify Women on X-Ray, like a month ago, who also, Rashida Saunders, who has a book out, a memoir out, and she also started writing because a therapist said something to her about just write, which just is so fascinating to me. Well, I think it's something that's not talked about that much that I just feel
it's like not, but like the second be. You start talking about it, it's so clear. It happens at corporeal writing too. If you enter story space, you can move things around that feel like monolithic and hegemonic and too heavy in your actual life. Mm-hmm. And so that burden of trauma loosens and becomes sediments, and you can move it around. So it makes sense. But even I wouldn't say writing stories is therapy. It's not that. It's that story space allows your story to move.
Mm-hmm. My day job for years was as a legal assistant, and I loved that job so much because the law is also all stories.
Yeah.
It's all stories. And it was fascinating to me. It's mostly different kinds of trauma, really, no matter what kind of law it is.
That's another thing people don't talk about enough. Law in America is based on a system of casuistry, which is basically whose story is going to win.
So what's that word you just said?
Casuistry.
Okay. So first of all, can you spell that for me?
Probably not.
Okay.
casuistry,
maybe. I like it.
Although that might get you close to whatever it is.
What is that?
It's just basically the idea that storytelling is going to reveal who wins and who loses. And we don't talk about that in this country. We talk about law like it's facts and it's evidences and it's proofs. But we ought to talk about it more.
It's all storytelling, which is funny because it's also really linked to capitalism,
yeah.
in my opinion, because now marketing 100%. Has taken over storytelling, which I have my own infuriates me. But that's
I agree with that entirely.
Another conversation. It's another radio
show. No, it may
show.
Come up.
What are we doing? You're listening to Bust the Canon on X-Ray FM. I'm Margaret Malone. Today's guest is author Lydia Yugnovich, memoirist, novelist, and founder of Corporeal Writing. Lydia was talking to us about Kathy Acker and Angry Women, both the title of a book and just in general, and a word I can't pronounce, but I will look up and put on the website, I promise you, with a definition, because now it's such a word dork. I'm fascinated by that. Okay, second question. Who is an, again, like in quotations, emerging or up-and-coming author or someone you feel like we need to have on our radar that you want to shine a little light on?
I did consider coming in, having memorized, and take a huge breath and just rallying off 100 authors.
That would have been awesome. I would have had to write really fast.
To get it into the ether. You know, I'm like, how can I jam my foot in this door? But the truth is, the answer comes quickly and easily to mind. It's Janice Lee. Mm. And you want to know why?
I absolutely want to know why.
Well, for 100 different reasons, but among them, there are writers out there who are writing to speak to and make a bridge to the market or to a system that anoints you as something called an author. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. It's the game, right? It's the matrix. We all participate in capitalism, whether we want to admit it or not. But once you've infiltrated, what you do there interests me. And Janice is not writing to the market in any way, shape, or form. Janice's writing has a direct relationship to the world around her. And I mean at the level of the sentence, at the level of the content. And when I say the sentence, what I mean is how a single sentence can travel. Mm. Not to follow Western traditions, for example, of plot and character development, but letting a sentence loose to travel between flower and old man and painting and sewer grate and bird. And that is a different relationship to language and to writing and to storytelling than those authors who are market-driven or market-inscribed. And a couple of concrete things she does so beautifully. She's often writing about interbeing, which is an engaged Buddhism practice notion. She's often exploring the Korean concept of Han in her writing. For me personally, and I know this from reading her book, Imagine a Death, over the last year and a half, over and over again, I've been reading it. Because, again, it was a practice that was helping me stay present and not get lost. In that book, there's interbeing, and in all of her books, there's a deep relationship between mother and daughter. Mm-hmm. And having lost my daughter, and she lost her mother, there's some story space where I am drawn to her core theme, mm-hmm. for different reasons than her, mm-hmm. but it helps me feel alive and that death is not what I hear other people saying death is. You know, when I'm in her story space around mothers and daughters and death and life, I feel at home. Mm-hmm. And I feel reminded that I too I'm connected to the world around me. And even though it doesn't look like it on the surface, maybe to some people, the market is irrelevant to me. I understand I have ascended on the surface, and I know that story and know what it looks like, but it isn't why I'm a writer or an artist, and it isn't why I do what I do in the world. Janice's books remind you why art exists. Mm. It's to remind us why we're human. Mm. So is it anti-capitalist? Maybe not. I mean, her books are books. You can buy them. But her project, her process, her orientation to the dominant thing we call the literary industry is profoundly a resistance. Profoundly a prayer, profoundly on the edges. couldn't be more different than Acrobat. Do you hear what I'm throwing down?
I do, and it's my brain is firing, and I want to go back for just a second to something you said Chronology of Water does and Corporeal does, which is this, the idea of aftercare. And it's the first time I've really started to think about the way readers turn to books for some level of care, I think, which I've never really thought about before, and how part of the reason there's such a wide variety of books is probably because people find care in different ways. And so now I'm like, okay, so Kathy Acker was care for you at that particular phase.
Sounds weird, but it's...
I totally get that.
Entirely true.
Yes. And so now a version of care is, it's not about the like slicker follow through of seeing something all the way through. It's like the care is contained in what Janice Lee is doing inside a sentence. And that's a different kind of care. And it's interesting to me. I've never really made that connection before, but I think that's very, very true. And I think it explains why some people, when things get really, really hard, need to read a genre piece where it's like someone dies and someone figures out who does it by the end, because that feels like someone's going to care. I'm going to be cared for by the time I'm done.
Yeah, yeah. I spent a whole year reading thrillers for that very reason. And it has nothing to do with, you know, whether thrillers are good or bad. It had to do with meeting something in me at the moment. And yeah, it took care of something in that moment for
me. So fascinating, because now I'm thinking about when my husband and I, when he went through his brain tumor diagnosis and the treatment, we had this year of just terrible, terrible time. We watched so much Law and Order. It was the only thing we could
made
do.
Sense at the
we
time.
Just we wa- like to this day when I hear the like boom boom at the beginning,
oh,
my
I have no
whole
doubt.
Nervous system goes into like
it's gonna be
I instantly feel better, and I'm realizing
it's
because,
get that.
Because like I felt cared for every,
I
even
so
though the
get
most
that.
Atrocious murders happen on that show.
Oh no, I so get that.
I felt cared for. And so I feel like storytelling and all the different ways it can work, whether it's to the market or against it. We are like we're caring for ourselves and others.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah,
it's interesting. So now I'm like, okay, what does the canon then have to do with that? What does the canon? How does care in the canon?
Yeah, I know. I mean, like, I can't hate this canon, this Western canon we've inherited, because it's like I can't hate Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. I've tried.
Yeah,
I tried really hard. Like that. Insert bad words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then I see, you know, like the iterations and other artist interpretations of Hamlet and this recent movie Hamnet, you know, becoming something else, which, by the way, that movie has dissolved me. I'm coming back, but I watched it like 17 times in a row. But, you know, that this Hamnet movie with Chloe Zhao directing and Jesse Buckley, who apparently is from outer space. She's not of this world. Like, that movie could get born from a Shakespeare play and study and research of his life and a fictional version that this woman author made into a novel. Like, I don't want that to go away. So I don't want the canon dead. I just tend to gravitate toward its edges and its deformations and reformations, which are interesting to me, if that makes any sense.
And so linking this back to Janice Lee for just a minute, I'm wondering if it's almost like, you know, the existence of the canon allows us to push against it, or the existence of something that Janice Lee is not allowed. Like, would Janice Lee and her writing exist if, you know, there weren't books to market?
I mean, I guess in my heart of hearts, I think, yes, it would screw the market because it's coming from such a different place in her. But I understand the question. And Janice, I work with her a lot, so I know this about her teaching practice. She's often remarking brilliantly on how certain constraints in a writing portal or prompt actually could make more come out of you than just saying, okay, free flow, write whatever you want, la, 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 there are no constraints whatsoever. And I've heard her speak eloquently about this constraints of the shape of a single sentence and what's possible there. But you have to slow down enough to take the sentence on as if it's an entire world or landscape. And she actually does that in her writing and in her teaching, and shows what the transformational possibilities are inside the constraint. And so when I think about that, I think, well, look how we can play with, agitate, and reform this canon nonsense. Mm-hmm. And look, there's dope. Let's play with it.
Which is, I mean, to my mind, how the canon was born anyway. Like, yeah. The canon wasn't born because it existed. The canon was born because someone started playing around, and thus, all of a sudden, we turned it into... technically, it's a constraint, if we want to go there. But I'm also very interested in constraint. I became mildly obsessed with the, I think, maybe Irish writer named John McGregor. Do you know John McGregor?
Yeah.
Who is big into constraints.
Yeah.
On the sentence level, as well as page level, paragraph, chapter, yeah, et cetera, which I find very fascinating and I think is incredibly liberating when we can only go so far, do whatever you want within this tiny box, go crazy.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting to see what people can do.
I mean, it's worth exploring, if nothing else, or, you know, worth slowing down and noticing. But what happens inside Janice's sentences, and inside her poetry too, is a single word or a single line or a single sentence, I think I said this earlier, travels differently on the page.
What does that mean?
Well, like, sometimes she's very interested in the long take in filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes a single sentence will go on a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Four pages, for example, which Janice isn't the first person to play around with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that. It's where she takes the sentence in terms of content and form that does some kind of magic on you and your body. Mm-hmm. It's how you can follow the sentence, for example, in Imagine a Death, down the leg to the grass, to the insects, to the dirt, and beyond death into the next story and more dirt and grass and a person or an animal or a dog. Like, you're willing to go beyond death with this sentence to see what else is available. Or, you know, when you get to the end of a sentence where the period is, makes you stop and think, what's a period? That's a big deal. That you can have those moments in her writing, that's a big deal.
So now I'm understanding too, when you first started talking about her, you were talking about this phrase interbeing, which I've heard referenced before. I think of Thich Nhat Hanh, and I'm sure there's other people that have talked about it, but I and I'm fascinated with interbeing. Like, it's one of those things that makes perfect sense to me, and I can't intellectually look at it too closely because it falls apart, but I can be inside interbeing very easily as long as I don't try and bring my intellectual brain into it. And I love the idea of somebody writing in that space that feels fascinating to
me. Obviously, you should reread Janice tonight.
Yes, obviously. And you also mentioned, interbeing, and then you mentioned a Korean teaching or term called Hong?
Yeah, and so I'm not the person to talk about this, but just briefly, I'm learning about it from Janice, and I'm you know, studying it to researching it to receive storytelling, you know, with more understanding. But it's a form of sadness or pain or kind of ancestral, you know, difficult emotions that carry over across time into peoples. And what Janice is doing with the concept of Han is very innovative. That's the important piece.
Okay. I do need to go home and read some Janice. Thank you.
Everyone does.
This is Bust the Canon on X-Ray FM. I'm Margaret Malone. Today's guest is author Lydia Yukovich. Thank you, Jim. For those of you who don't know what that was the Law and Order bong bong that strangely quiets my nervous system. Thank you so much. My blood pressure just dropped.
I almost tinkled, but...
Where was I? This is Bust the Cannon. Lydia Yuknovich is our guest today. She's written the memoirs Reading the Waves and Chronology of Water and the novels Thrust, The Book of Joan, The Small Backs of Children, and Dora, A Head Case. We were just talking about, you know, Interbeing and Janice Lee and the sentence level of, I don't know how words can't help me now. Okay, third question. Let's pivot. Okay, so we sort of started to go here, but now I'm going to just, let's just go here. Is there a canon? We've kind of talked about that. Is there a canon? What is it? How does it have value? What does it matter to you as a writer or a painter? Or like, let's just go there.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is partly why I say I've tried to hate Shakespeare and I have failed to hate Shakespeare. But I figured out it's not really about Shakespeare. If there was a thing we could call the canon, and having taught literature for 30 years, there were certainly books that claimed there's a canon of literature. If it ever existed, it became a product from, sad to say, colonizer impulses. Mm-hmm. And it's part of a longer story of making an exclusive and kind of colonizer space where certain voices and stories are celebrated and others are kept out. And quite often the case is that those writers and artists and bodies at the margins of living lives are the ones kept out. And so it's a political entity that has indeed existed to oppress, repress, and in the other direction, celebrate and make authoritative some voices over others. And so to say it doesn't exist or never existed is to erase the political harm. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say it doesn't exist. I would say that we are living in a time where its dissolution is important and its edges I was going to use the word destroy, but I think I mean destory its existence in a way that is good and matters. Mm. So that, you know, whatever new shapes emerge, they will be multiple and various and diverse and not allegiant to this strange monolith of a shape that shuts some voices out and lionizes other voices. That's, I find that idea really hopeful, mm-hmm. that as the canon comes apart and is restoried, it's this polyphonic, mm-hmm. Squirming, kind of monstrous creature that is has many voices and contradictions and tensions and explosions and, you know, births and deaths. Kind of more like nature.
I'm thinking about how, just agreeing with you that the canon's got to be rooted in colonialism. There's just no way, because we were oral storytelling for millennia before the canon came along, and that was communal, multiple voices telling the same story differently every time they told it, adding things, changing things. That's not canon, right? I mean, that's different. It seems different to me.
It's completely different. The canon emerged with systems of power and knowledge and control, and those all got born around the same time. Mm-hmm. And so categorizing what shall be literature versus what is human and messy and interactive, mm-hmm. That got colonized.
I just feel happy that I'm realizing I've never defined you know, I've never defined canon as storytelling, and I've never confused storytelling with canon and canon with storytelling. And I don't know if other people have either. And that feels actually like I've never thought that all the way through. And I think that's right. And I'm so glad, because that means they don't get storytelling.
No, I mean, in our hearts and our bodies, we know that storytelling crosses all borders and transgresses and doesn't give a hootie. Mm-hmm. Look how sanitized my language is.
Hootie is my favorite not bad word, bad word. I'm using that from now on.
Doesn't give a hootie about, you know, where it comes, goes, gets born, dies, interacts with, has sex with, you know. Mm-hmm. Stories can do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And that the canon emerged, okay, so did empire. That doesn't mean we have to keep allegiance to it.
Mm-hmm. You've said repeatedly about different things during our time here today, this idea of the edges of things, and what's the other phrase, margins, the edges, and what, I don't know, what's going on there? What does that mean to you? And I think part of what's interesting to me is, in order for margins and edges to exist, it still implies some containment, fencing, something. So how, I have a question and I don't know how to articulate it. Yeah.
I hear that. When the Misfits Manifesto came out, I had a catchphrase that I would write when I was signing books. Mm-hmm. And it was something like, that it's the shimmering edges that give the center its shape.
Mm-hmm.
And so what interests me is the relationship between what gets formed as a core or a center or the dominant shape, mm-hmm, and its relationship to its own quivering, mm-hmm, shimmering edges.
Mm-hmm.
And so the shape needs the edges to be a shape at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the edges have some relationship to the shape, whether it's I want to help form it or I want to agitate it.
Right.
And so I think about that as one way to talk about the relationship. And when, mm-hmm, I have to choose, I try to choose, I gravitate toward the edges. But, you know, how people interpret what I do and don't do is their deal, but, mm-hmm, that's how it feels to be me, mm-hmm, on the inside.
That's great. That feels exactly right. Thank you for answering a question I had trouble articulating, but that is exactly what I was asking. And I think what's interesting also to me about that is this way that I think I can't help but think of essentially like a star or the sun or something, and how it looks like it's a sphere, it's a round sphere, but actually
not.
It's not. And how I'm also thinking, as relates to writing, I guess specifically, and writers, authors, capital A authors, that there are some who you're saying who are pulling away from the center. And I think there are also some desperately headed toward and yet still on the margins.
Yeah.
And that tension it holds us all, which is fascinating to me.
It's fascinating to me too. And, you know, we don't have as much choice about all this as we wish we had.
Oh, sister.
So remind myself on the daily by collaborating with other artists and writers that it's the collaboration we do together and the relationships we, you know, create inside that collaboration that matters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the practice,
mm-hmm,
the collective.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody spits out and becomes famous,
mm-hmm,
or somebody toils away in obscurity their entire life,
mm-hmm,
or somebody gets money, or somebody gets, you know, a kind of special prize, mm-hmm, those things matter less than how do we keep the energy moving so that more of us can feel like we're alive and not dead.
Mm-hmm. And that might be, I mean, the last question I like to ask people, and maybe that is the answer, I don't know, but it's like, what can we do to break apart the canon, bust up the canon, hover at the edges? Like, what do you, is it collaboration? What is it for you?
Well, it has been for the last, for maybe my whole adult life. It seemed like locking arms, mm-hmm, and exploring and writing and making art together and making space for each other and resisting together has been useful. And I still think that. I just, at the age I'm at, have also noticed I have pretty intimate and deep relationships with non-human beings that I'm thinking about. Like, my relationship to the planet and animals is rising in me, and so I have to go think about that.
When you think about things, do you think about them like through language, through painting, through image, or is it for example, exploring that, what you're talking about, how does that, you're using the word thinking, but I'm wondering, is it thinking?
No, it's almost entirely sensory perception and intuitive impulses. I don't know what else to call
them.
Yeah,
I get it.
Like, sensory perception is understandable.
Yes.
Deep sensory perception.
Yeah.
I have found intimacy with non-human things that I can't even make sentences about. But in terms of intuitive impulses, I mean, you know, coming home and knowing it is true that this is burgundy. But you can't tell a story about it. Or this is why the paintings have been useful for me, because I can make some burgundy and it doesn't have to mean something. It's just burgundy.
It just is what it is.
Yeah.
Yes, I've always wished I was a visual artist, because there's so, you just get to remove a part of the process that as a writer you don't have the privilege of doing.
Yeah, I highly encourage people to go take a peek at the small amount of Rothko paintings at the Portland Art Museum right now, because it's the good reminder that you stand in front of a Rothko painting long enough and what you think is just a giant, you know, swath of red and purple starts becoming something in your experience eventually. It's very Buddhist.
One last question. In your writing life and just in your Lydianess, water is really important to you and comes up a lot, the ocean, water. How is that, just to bring it back full circle to the painting, is water connected to you at all with the painting? Has that met up yet for you as you've been exploring?
Oh, absolutely. Predominantly, I'd say at least 70% of the quote-unquote paintings that came out of me had a kind of oceanic and spheric and wave shape thing going on, and that tracks back to my very primal relationship to water. But I wasn't like standing there going, make one that looks like an ocean wave at all. I just, again, as an intuitive impulse, would make a certain motion and certain colors would do waving. And, you know, so I have a whole bunch of them if you want.
I'm going to crawl under your bed and come look at the paintings.
There are way too many of these wave things.
Eventually they'll like raise your bed up.
And you'll float. Will.
It'll be like a magic, like a floating carpet.
Like Princess and the Pea.
Yes. And then you'll have trouble sleeping. Lydia, thank you.
My pleasure.
Oh my,
I love
goodness.
Talking to you.
I so appreciate your time. I appreciate you coming in, being here live in person with just like the extra special, special, special. Once again, thank you so much to today's guest, Lydia Yuknovich, author of the memoirs Reading the Waves and The Chronology of Water, as well as the novels Thrust, Book of Joan, Small Backs of Children, and Dora. Please go seek out the adaptation of her memoir, Chronology of Waves, by Kristen Stewart, and check out her micro arts organization, Corporeal Writing, where she co-teaches with the squad. If you'd like to learn more about Lydia or any of the writers or books we talked about today, they will be up on the Bust the Canon website, which you can find online or through the X-ray page. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back the first Monday of May on X-ray FM, where radio is yours. See you then.
home.